Still no response from the colony, even though he's had someone trying to hail them since we left Starbase 11. He's also got his engineers pulling out every trick they know to extend power to the ship's long-range sensors, but we are still too far away. Maybe in an hour or so. At the ship's present speed, they were less than 10 hours from their destination. Tarsis 4. It was but one of numerous Federation colony worlds about which Georgiou knew nothing. Calling up information from the Narbonne's computer had done little to enlighten her beyond the usual collection of statistics regarding the settlement's founding and the number of people who called the planet home. Of particular interest was its selection as the new home for refugees from another colony that had suffered a disaster requiring total evacuation of that world. Georgiou recalled reading about that in some report. Such drastic action was uncommon enough that it would draw attention, but it was also one of the things she noted in her quest to understand the cause of the situation into which she and her team were wading. "When I was at the Academy, I had friends who grew up on colony worlds," she said as they proceeded farther into the bay. "After we left Starbase 11, I reached out to a few of them I knew had lived through some tough times, such as extreme weather events, earthquakes, and even disease. Nothing on this scale, but I thought it'd be helpful to have an idea of what to expect from the colonists when we arrive." To that end, Georgiou pestered Captain Koropati and the Narbonne's communications officer to locate and dispatch subspace messages to her former classmates, all of whom were scattered to various ships or installations. Her idea paid off, as she was able to get some fresh insight into the mindset of colonists besieged by crisis. Jen asked, "What did your friends have to say?" "The Federation has contingency plans for all sorts of things," replied Georgiou. "Tarsis IV is a bit of a problem, because its population is much larger than you'd expect to see this far out from the major population centers." She knew this was the result of their relocation effort, which added 6,000 colonists to the 2,000 already living on Tarsis IV. Though the resettlement was unusual in its scope, the planet was more than capable of supporting a community of that size.
"Or so we thought."
"Even the best plans take time to implement," said Jen, "especially when we're talking about planets light years away from populated or well-trafficked regions. No matter how fast our ships can go, space is still very big."
Georgiou nodded.
"And helping 8,000 people is no easy task."
The situation on Tarsis IV, as reported during her mission briefing from the commander of Starbase 11, Admiral Brett Anderson, was dire. Food supplies and the ability to create more had been savaged by a fungal contamination unlike anything previously encountered, placing the lives of the entire population in jeopardy. After the receipt of the original distress call, initial estimates from Starfleet put the arrival of rescue ships at the colony in just over a month, at which point any remaining food stores on the planet would be long exhausted. The Tarsis IV settlers were looking at hard times, barring a miracle, which had come in two-part form. First was word that a ship of the line was presently speeding at high warp back from its patrol of the Federation Klingon border. A Constitution-class starship, one of Starfleet's newest and most powerful vessels, would be able to provide all manner of support upon its arrival, including dedicated science and engineering teams that could tackle the problem of the still active infection.
"Assuming we strike out when we get there, of course."
Providing a more immediate response was the eclectic mix of officers and civilian specialists cobbled together by Admiral Anderson, placed under Georgiou's charge and thrown aboard the Narbonne. Members of the team she commanded, many of whom she did not even yet know by name, maneuvered and worked around the stacks of cargo containers and other storage vessels taking up deck space here. Like her, these men and women had been working at a breakneck pace since leaving Starbase 11 less than 40 hours earlier. Everything about this response was being executed in hurried fashion, because that was all for which there was time. But Georgiou was still working to assemble a viable plan that would deploy her people, as well as the supplies they were bringing,
in the most efficient manner. She had pored over every scrap of information about Tarsus IV and its capital city, New Anchorage, using that data to configure her plan with an emphasis on distribution of materiel as well as the decontamination and restoration efforts of the colony's food manufacturing and processing infrastructure. All of that would have to be addressed within the first days of the Narbonne's arrival, and Georgiou wanted her team to hit the ground running, as it would be up to them to hold the line until other ships arrived to augment the assistance effort. She and her people might be tired now, but she was certain their preparations would pay off once they made planetfall.
Bridge to Commander Georgiou.
The voice of Captain Korapati echoed in the cargo bay, and it took Georgiou a moment to locate a communications panel on a nearby bulkhead. Moving to it, she thumbed its activation control.
Georgiou here?
Sorry to interrupt your work, Commander, but I'd like to see you in my ready room.
Georgiou exchanged looks with Jen, her eyes widening in surprise.
What might this mean?
I'll be right there, sir.
She severed the connection before turning back to Jen.
I don't know how long this is going to take, but let the team know to finish whatever they've got going and to take a break. We'll get back to it in 5 hours.
It was not the ideal reward for the hard work her people had been performing to this point, but it would have to suffice. There would be time for rest later.
Aye, Commander, replied Jen.
Georgiou exited the cargo bay, maneuvering down the corridor toward a ladder junction. It had taken her less than a day to acclimate herself to the Narbonne's deck plan, owing to its size and layout. Not a ship of the line or even an advanced science vessel, this was a colony support vessel, a utilitarian craft designed for the sort of heavy-duty grunt work required to establish, refurbish, or even salvage or relocate planet-bound settlements. Essentially, an overlong cylinder with warp nacelles tucked against its upper primary hull, most of its interior spaces consisted of immense cargo holds and berthing compartments of the sort needed to transport large numbers of people and even livestock. Designed for planetary landings, the vessel could also serve as shelter for newly arrived settlers until more permanent housing was constructed. The rest of the ship was a relatively simple network of connecting corridors and service conduits. Unlike starships with turbolift systems that ran horizontally as well as vertically, the Narbonne possessed only standard elevators connecting its 8 decks with pairs of cars located forward, aft, and amidships. Georgiou learned on her first day aboard that it was more efficient to utilize the network of ladder wells if she wanted to get somewhere fast. Thanks to this, she arrived on the bridge less than 5 minutes after the captain's summons. She found him not in the raised seat at the center of the room, but instead standing at one of the perimeter workstations, hovering over the officer seated there. In his late 50s, at least according to the personnel file Georgiou had reviewed, Aurobindo Korapati was a slender man, with close-cropped, stark white hair that provided an acute contrast to his dark brown skin. His uniform appeared to fit him to exacting precision, and his boots were polished to a high gleam. Even without the captain's rank on his uniform, everything about the man seemed to yell, "The one in charge."
"Thank you for coming, Commander," he said, upon noticing her arrival as she crossed the bridge toward him. "I apologize again for taking you from your work, but this is something I think deserves your input."
Despite his position as ranking officer on the ship, Korapati was a man of unfailing politeness in all things. He had a calm, unruffled demeanor about him that Georgiou appreciated, all the more because she knew the captain had not always been the master of a simple colony support vessel. A review of his service record prior to the Narbonne's departure from Starbase 11 revealed to her that Korapati was born on Mars to parents who migrated to the planet from Chennai, India, on Earth. He previously served as first officer and later captain on the USS Gloucester, a long-range patrol ship that had seen its share of tough scrapes and combat during his tenure. Most of that action was against marauders or Orion pirates, from whom Korapati defended civilian merchant shipping and the occasional Federation colony. This was a man who had been tested beyond the confines of classrooms and computer simulations. That carried weight with Giorgio, who had left her former, more martial career path in favor of contributing to Starfleet's ever-expanding interstellar exploration mandate.
"What can I do for you, sir?"
Motioning for her to follow him, Korapati began crossing the bridge. Like the rest of the ship, the Narbonne's nerve center was a testament to function over form. Workstations encircled the bridge's command area, which contained the captain's chair, as well as consoles for the helm and operations officers. At this time of ship's night, only a third of the stations were occupied. Everything about the bridge suggested a vessel that did not benefit from the regular maintenance and care afforded to ships of the line. Instead, it was the transport's crew of talented and dedicated engineers and other technicians who kept the Narbonne flying. That much was obvious to Giorgio within hours of coming aboard and assuming her role as passenger. The hatch leading to the captain's ready room was set into the bulkhead near the bridge's aft section, just to the right of the hatch connecting the compartment to a service corridor and the rest of the ship. Korapati led the way into the adjoining room and Giorgio followed, stepping inside and allowing the door to close behind her. "Coffee?" asked Korapati as he moved to a counter extending from the wall at the rear of the room. The space held a food slot and, to Giorgio's surprise, a coffee pot sitting in its own brewing machine.
"You make your own?" she asked.
Korapati nodded.
"Absolutely." He gestured toward the food slot. "I've tried everything I can think of to program a proper recipe into that contraption, but it's hopeless."
Holding up the cup in his hand, he added,
"My brother sells his own blends to old-fashioned types like me. This one he made just for me, and I keep the recipe in my safe, along with the other documents and codes vital to Federation security."
Unable to stifle a chuckle as she accepted the cup, Giorgio nodded in appreciation.
"I'm honored."
She declined the offer of any sweeteners, preferring her coffee without additives.
"Help yourself, once you've decided it's the best coffee you've ever tasted."
After pouring a cup for himself, Korapati moved to the chair behind his small, angled desk, which sat in one corner facing the door. He motioned for her to take the couch built into an alcove next to the desk. Giorgio took the opportunity to examine the small set of shelves built into the wall opposite the coffee maker, noting the selection of old-style hardcover books along with a few keepsakes. She smiled, admiring the collection and thinking of the small library she had amassed over the years and carried with her from one assignment to the next. Like hers, the books here were a blend of older, weathered volumes and recent facsimile editions. She noted that the captain's reading tastes ran the gamut from philosophy and history, human and otherwise, to classic literature and even a few modern fiction titles. The last category indicated Korapati was a traditionalist in many aspects of his life beyond ceding his coffee needs to a machine. He seemed to share her preference for the look and feel of a physical book to its electronic counterpart.
"As you can imagine," he said after sipping from his coffee, "this isn't something I'm eager to discuss in front of the crew. Right now, only my first officer and my communication staff are aware of what I'm about to tell you. I'd like it kept that way, at least until we know more."
Cradling her coffee cup in her hands, Giorgio replied,
"Understood, Captain."
Korapati leaned back in his seat, leaving his cup on the desk and idly tracing its edge with the fingers of his right hand.
"There's been no response from Tarsus IV. We're not even sure they're receiving our hails. To say I don't like what that might mean is an understatement."
"Particularly since there's been no other contact since Starbase 11 received the initial distress call 3 days ago."
"Exactly. According to Admiral Anderson, the colony didn't even acknowledge his message that rescue ships were on the way far sooner than originally anticipated."
Korapati frowned.
"One would think that calls for celebration or something."
Giorgio asked, "Any word from the other ships detailed to the rescue operation?"
Still playing with his coffee cup, Korapati shook his head.
"Not yet.
At last report, two were pushing to get to Starbase 11 by the end of the day, loaded and heading out toward us 12 hours after that. The other ship is running silent until it's well enough away from the area of its last assignment. Apparently Starfleet Command wants its movements kept under wraps as much as possible. He shrugged. There are three others in that ship class due for deployment by the end of the year. We're not going to be able to keep the Constitutions a secret forever.
Given her pending assignment to the USS Defiant, following her previous posting aboard the science vessel Archimedes, Georgiou had reviewed the technical specifications for the Constitution-class starships. They were the crown jewels in Starfleet's rollout of long-duration, deep-space exploration vessels, intended for multi-year missions while operating well away from the support structure of starbases and other facilities. The initial fleet of 12 ships would also serve as the latest word in force projection toward the borders of Federation space. They would stand toe-to-toe with whatever might be thrown at them from the likes of interstellar adversaries like the Klingon and Romulan empires. There were those who questioned the need for vessels so overtly intended for military missions, given the present state of relations. No encounters with Romulans had been reported for more than 80 years following the Earth-Romulan War that preceded the founding of the Federation. Beaten back by an alliance of Earth, Vulcan, Andorian, and Tellarite forces, the Romulans appeared content to retreat behind their borders and leave the rest of the quadrant well enough alone. But longtime Starfleet veterans like Georgiou knew that it was only a matter of time before the Empire resurfaced. The same was believed true for the Klingon Empire, which also seemed to be ignoring Federation space and ships in favor of concerns elsewhere. It had been years since the last recorded run-in with a Klingon ship. How long would that uneasy peace last?
Not long enough.
His expression sobering, Koropati leaned forward in his chair, resting his forearms atop his desk.
Commander, I don't mind saying I'm uncomfortable with how all of this is playing out. I don't like not knowing the colony's current situation, or what we may be walking into. There's something just not right about all of this, but I'm damned if I can tell you what I think it is.
I understand, sir. Experience and instinct told Georgiou that something odd was happening on Tarsus IV. Beyond the reported plague and its disastrous effects, what else could have befallen the luckless colony? Even without primary communications, there still were other methods of establishing contact. A distress beacon could be launched from the planet, for example, programmed to head for Starbase 11, or broadcast a message until it was detected by a passing ship. After finishing her coffee, Georgiou pushed herself from the couch and made her way to the coffee maker, helping herself to another cup of the captain's personal brew. It really is pretty damned good.
Wait, she said, remembering something she recalled from her mission briefing. She turned from the counter to face Koropati.
What about the Starfleet outpost there?
The captain scowled.
No contact with them either. Their last status report was also 3 days ago, and indicated they had plenty of supplies to ride out the crisis until help arrived, but only if they isolated themselves from the rest of the colony. The leader of the team there, Lieutenant Commander Loka, reported that they would be donating their untainted supplies to the cause and throwing in their lots with the rest of the civilians.
A small gesture, but an important one.
Georgiou recalled from her review of the colony's history that the outpost predated the settlement's founding, part of Starfleet's ongoing efforts to monitor Federation borders and potential threats from beyond the imaginary lines that served to divide territory on uncounted stellar cartography maps. As for the colony itself, despite its tendency to eschew as much direct Federation oversight as possible, the people living on the planet maintained a good relationship with the Starfleet contingent. She knew that whatever meager food stores the outpost team possessed would not go very far toward mitigating the larger crisis facing the colonists, but the act would still generate goodwill and a sense of shared sacrifice with everyone forced to endure such hardship. Of course, now the question was,
Why were Commander Lorca and his team also out of contact? Were they experiencing difficulties similar or related to those affecting the colony? Too many questions about this mission were piling up, with no easy access to answers, and Georgiou was beginning to sense some of the same uncertainty and even dread she knew Captain Koropati must be feeling. "I'm starting to feel like it's the first day of swimming lessons," she said, "and the instructor just pitched me into the deep end of the pool with a sandbag around my neck." Koropati was tapping his fingers on his desk.
"About the only advice I can offer at this point is the same thing I'll be telling my crew. Be ready for anything, Commander. We're walking into a dark room with no idea where the light switch is or who might be hiding in there."
"That's how we've proceeded from the start, Captain." With no real information about the situation, Georgiou opted to develop a plan that envisioned the worst-case scenario and relied upon no assistance from the colonists themselves. If they arrived and it turned out the inhabitants of Tarsus IV were able to help, so much the better. But until she could prove otherwise, she was operating under the assumption that she and her team were on their own. Not only were they tasked with rendering immediate aid to the colonists, but Georgiou also carried the responsibility of determining whether the situation warranted a full-scale evacuation of the entire population. Such a decision could not be made until she was on site and able to assess the extent of the emergency and its impacts not only on the inhabitants, but the planet itself. Would Tarsus IV even be capable of sustaining life once the present crisis was addressed? That question would remain unanswered until a comprehensive study of the fungal infection was completed. It would also have to be prioritized behind the immediate need to assist the Tarsus IV colonists through the calamity they faced. For all Georgiou knew, it would be up to whoever was sent to relieve Captain Koropati as the senior Starfleet officer in charge of the response force. At Starbase 11, while awaiting transport to her next assignment as first officer aboard the USS Defiant, Georgiou found herself drafted by the Admiral into emergency service and attached to the transport vessel for temporary duty. Working with the resources at his disposal, Anderson pulled together enough people to form a medical team, security detail, various technical specialists, and a detachment from Starfleet's Corps of Engineers. A third of the special detachment was pulled from Starbase 11's permanent crew, with the balance filled out by personnel like Georgiou, all on their way somewhere else when duty and fate came calling. While Captain Koropati retained command of his vessel and overall authority for this first phase of Starfleet response to the emergency, she would be responsible for deploying her team as appropriate for whatever they might find once the Narbonne made planetfall. They were a stopgap measure, as the Admiral put it. First responders. The whistle of the ship's intercom intruded at that moment, followed by what she recognized as the voice of Commander Natalie Larson, the Narbonne's first officer.
"Bridge to Captain Koropati. You asked to be advised when we entered maximum sensor range of the Tarsus system. We've crossed that threshold and initiated a sweep of the area. There are no signs of other ship traffic, and we're still not picking up any communications from the colony either."
Exchanging a glance with Georgiou, Koropati asked,
"What's our ETA?"
"Approximately 9 hours, 20 minutes at our present speed, sir."
"Continue on course and maintain sensor sweeps. Keep trying to raise the colony at 30-minute intervals. Notify me once we are close enough to scan the planet or if anything else changes."
"Aye, sir. Bridge out."
Once the communication was terminated, Koropati reached up to rub the bridge of his nose.
"They're being rather stubborn, aren't they?"
he asked after a moment. Georgiou nodded.
"Looks that way, sir."
"Remember what I said about being ready for anything?"
"Yes."
"Well, now you've got about 9 hours to be ready for everything else, too."
5.
I've never seen the streets this crowded.
Walking a footpath through the park that served as New Anchorage's central green space, Gabriel Lorca and Terry Bridges did their best to act as though they were just two more citizens making their way toward the amphitheater.
"Yeah," said Bridges. 4,000 people heading in the same direction will have that effect. The curfew's not for 2 more hours, after all."
"Increased security presence." Lorca had noted dozens of uniformed officers, most standing at major intersections or at the entrances to various buildings. With the curfew in effect across the city and outlying settlements, he suspected their numbers would be stretched as they worked to enforce the new mandate. He did not doubt that a significant percentage of the force also was deployed to the amphitheater to help with crowd control. That was fine by him. Like him, Bridges sported civilian attire in accordance with his instructions. Traveling via transporter to the city's outskirts, all team members carried phasers, the weapons hidden beneath civilian jackets or under shirts so as not to attract undue attention. They did not have their communicators, as Lorca opted to leave them behind on the chance their frequencies could be tracked. After the incident at the outpost, he eyed every colony security officer they encountered. No one seemed to be reacting with any degree of recognition, but he already had decided against taking any unnecessary chances. That included entering the amphitheater or going where security personnel might be concentrated. He wanted the ability to escape and disappear into the crowd if circumstances required such action.
"It's this way," he said, pointing toward an apartment building situated along the park's western perimeter.
Belena Ferrasini lived here. With the outpost's communications array still offline, Lorca was forced to rely on civilian systems in order to attempt reaching her. She had not answered his first call, so he left a message informing her of their imminent arrival. Even as he and Bridges approached Belena's apartment from the south, Asal Sotani was making his way there from the north. It was Lorca's hope that not traveling together would allow the team to further escape attention by colony security. Entering the building proved to be no trouble. Even the one security officer they saw on the street appeared to pay them no notice. Likewise, gaining access to Belena's residence also came without incident, as Lorca possessed the entry code for her door's keypad lock, which he had shared with the rest of the team in the event they were forced to split up and evade pursuit by the security force. "Belena," he called out as he entered the apartment and the foyer light came on in response to his presence. "Are you here?" With Bridges following him, he stepped farther into the domicile, allowing the door to slide closed behind them. The front hall opened into the apartment's living room, which was decorated in understated fashion with a sofa and a pair of overstuffed recliners situated around a low-rise coffee table. Everything rested on a large area rug that Lorca knew Belena had purchased from a Tellarite merchant in the city's market district. Bookcases lined the walls to his left and right, except for one section that was dominated by a viewing screen typical for a residence of this size. The screen allowed the viewer access to colony and federation news networks, as well as personal and community entertainment libraries. The far wall was composed of bay windows extending from floor to ceiling. A door was set into the windows, allowing access to a large balcony upon which sat a pair of lounge chairs and a small round table. Art adorned what little wall space remained, and the bookcases were stuffed almost to overflowing with old-fashioned printed books of all shapes and sizes, along with a smattering of smaller framed photographs and other keepsakes. Lorca's eyes paused at one picture, cradled in a silver frame, of himself and Belena. He was shirtless while she wore a two-piece swimsuit, with brilliant blue water and fine white sand serving as a backdrop. It was from an excursion to the colony's one coastal village a month earlier, and he could not help smiling at the memories of the week spent there together.
"Nice place," Bridges offered.
Grunting in acknowledgement, Lorca moved to the small desk occupying the room's far corner. A square wooden bowl, the kind every vendor might swear was carved from the first tree felled on a colony, was filled with slips from the various fortune cookies he had given her to open. Why she kept them, he did not know, but it was one of those little quirks he loved about her. Absent-mindedly, he selected one at random and glanced at it before putting it in a pocket. He turned on the small lamp, and atop the desk lay a notepad and pen. The pad's top sheet contained a message, written in what he recognized as Belena's hand.
"Gabe, went to the gathering. We'll never find each other in that crowd, so if you get this, watch the speech and wait for me. Hope to see you soon. Love, Belena."
After listening to him read the note aloud, Bridges asked,
"She calls you Gabe? That's sweet."
"She's one of the very few who can without risking serious injury."
Lorca offered a small grin to show he was joking, but the truth was that he did prefer to be addressed by his proper name. Belena ignored this wish, playfully, of course, and in truth he had grown rather comfortable with her doing so. The sound of the apartment's front door opening made Lorca and Bridges reach for their phasers, only stopping themselves at the sight of Asal Soltani entering the foyer.
"Good to see you two," offered Soltani as the new arrival joined his companions. "Am I the only one who's happy to be off the street?"
"Not even close," Bridges replied.
Stepping away from Belena's desk, Lorca gestured toward the viewing screen.
"Belena's gone to the amphitheater, and she's asked for us to wait for her. We can watch the whole thing here."
It still struck him as odd that the new governor, Kodos, would opt for such a seemingly inefficient means of relaying information to the colony, when a speech broadcast over the colony news network would be faster and reach everyone simultaneously. Perhaps Belena was right, and this was as much an assembly for morale and reassurance as it was for the dissemination of information, at least some of which would be less than pleasant. Having moved to take a seat on the sofa, Soltani reached for the control pad sitting atop the coffee table, pressing controls to activate the screen and select the channel for the colony's primary news network.
"It's off to 8 p.m., he said. "The speech should be starting soon."
The image coalesced into a montage of breathtaking vistas. Lush forests, spectacular mountain ranges, framed by brilliant blue skies, cascading waterfalls, ocean waves surging against bright white sands. Lorca recognized some of the locations, having visited them either with Belena or one of his team. These soon were replaced by images of New Anchorage, a vibrant city teeming with activity. Impressive buildings, along with the art and sculpture that adorned several of its public parks, intermingled with pictures of men, women, and children engaged in a variety of work or recreation. Many of the city's landmarks were represented, including the spaceport and the governor's building, which faded and were replaced by striking views of expansive farmland and rows of greenhouses and irrigation systems.
"This is our world," said a deep, commanding voice. "It was not a gift. All that is here, all that we've come to love, appreciate, and depend upon, is a product of our dedication and labor, along with those of your parents and their parents before them. Since this colony was founded, those who call it home have been driven by a single desire, the right of simple self-determination. For more than a century, that was the promise of Tarsus IV. Those of you descended from the initial settlers welcomed people like me into your midst, people who shared your values and who sought the same goals and purpose in life. Like so many others, I was inspired to follow your example and to do my part to contribute to the greater whole."
The scenes of teeming landscapes and thriving agriculture disappeared, replaced with a new string of images that were far more sobering. Now the farms were blackened and dead, or were depicted as their crops burned, sending pillars of dark smoke spewing toward the heavens. When the pictures changed to those of people, gone was the happiness and promise of lives fulfilled. Instead, there were masks of concern, fear, and anguish. Children cried. Babies wailed. Adults appeared forlorn, as though ready to surrender or buckle in the face of overwhelming strife.
"Everything for which we've worked is threatened. The short-sightedness of a few has threatened us all. If we do not act, it will all disappear, yanked from us as a consequence of rash action, and also as punishment for crimes perpetrated not by us, but rather against us,
Make no mistake. A reckoning is upon us. And it is how we respond to this challenge that will define the legacy of this world for all time.
The screen shifted to what Lorca recognized as a view of the amphitheater, as if one was standing at its far end, looking across an expanse of people toward a dais that towered above those milling about on the ground. He noted that no one sat in the stands or along the walking paths or tunnel entrances leading to concourses underneath the rows of elevated seating, though security guards were stationed at random intervals along the walkway encircling the stands at their midpoint. Meanwhile, the thousands of assembled colonists stood on the grass. The lights, clusters of bulbs affixed to tall metal columns arranged around the venue's perimeter, illuminated the field and part of the raised platform, but Lorca saw that the area holding a podium was cast in shadow.
"Pretty crowded down there," observed Bridges, who had taken a seat next to Soltani. "Why not use the stands?"
Lorca, his arms crossed as he stood behind the sofa, shook his head. "No idea, other than maybe it's the fastest way to get people in and out."
Pointing to the screen, Soltani said,
"Something's up on the dais. I think it's starting."
All eyes turned to the screen as a figure moved from the darkness at the rear of the dais to the podium. Lorca saw what appeared to be a human, or at least humanoid, male, the upper half of his body still cloaked in shadows. Was this a consequence of the camera angle or a deliberate choice? The effect was amplified by the bright illumination on the amphitheater field, upon which Lorca guessed there had to be somewhere in the vicinity of 4,000 people, or about half of the colony's total population. Guards stood at each corner of the dais, with two more positioned behind the figure at the podium. Their uniforms were all but identical to those worn by the group that had infiltrated the outpost, and Lorca felt a twinge of irritation as he studied them. Though all carried sidearms, the weapons remained in holsters at each officer's waist.
"Has a thing for theatrics, doesn't he?"
said Bridges. No one offered comments in response to her question. There was a crackle of static, indicating the activation of an audio broadcast system, at which point a single voice boomed through speakers situated around the amphitheater.
"Good evening, citizens of Tarsus IV. I am Governor Kodos, and I stand before you tonight not only as your new leader, but also as a member of this community which finds itself at the brink of catastrophe. Rest assured that the contagion that has ravaged our food supply will soon be contained. But the damage it has wrought is severe and demands extreme action on our part if we are to survive. Distress calls have been dispatched, but the latest reports from Starfleet tell us that assistance is nearly a month away, far longer than we can survive at our present food levels. As a consequence, a number of emergency protocols have been enacted for the safety and security of all citizens. Many of those whom you have entrusted with leading this colony through prosperity and adversity have failed you. That they allowed the situation we now face to come about at all is crime enough. But then they compounded their offense by having no vision for how best to confront this crisis that threatens us all. Navigating this difficult time will present no shortage of challenges. Success depends on being able to make difficult, even impossible, choices. The leaders you elected to shoulder this responsibility have proven unworthy of the trust you gave them. Because of this, I, along with a group of equally brave and committed souls, have stepped forward, answering the call to an unwanted duty. With their able assistance, it is I who will lead you through this most trying of circumstances. We've already assumed control of critical roles within the colony government, assessed our situation and the resources available to address this crisis, and made some difficult decisions. The unassailable truth is that we simply cannot feed 8,000 people until assistance arrives. Even with strict rationing, we will exhaust our supplies in just a handful of days. Help is weeks away, if not longer. We therefore face harsh, unforgiving choices. There were those who have taken issue with our methods and our conclusions, to the point that their dissension might well spell disaster for us all. We were left with no choice but to proceed despite such resistance. If we are to secure our future, we must free ourselves from the shackles of safe, conventional thinking which can only lead us down a path toward doom. What we do from this point forward must be with the best interests of the community at its center.
Kodos paused in response to a chorus of murmurs and other sounds of concern and uncertainty emanating from the crowd assembled before him. Lorca watched as the security officers flanking him at the corners of the dais rested their hands on their holstered weapons. Sultani asked, "What the hell is he going on about? He sounds like he's beating back total anarchy with a club or something."
"Given what we're dealing with," replied Bridges, "some dissension is to be expected."
She raised an almost Vulcan-like right eyebrow.
"Hence the curfew and expanded security presence, among other things."
On the screen, the audience had quelled their various reactions to the governor's speech, and Kodos continued.
"We will press forward and do what must be done if we are to preserve all for which this community was founded and what it has labored to achieve. We must do this despite the uncertainty and even cowardice that held back my predecessors. That means making sacrifices for the greater good, in accordance with a series of directives I am implementing immediately. What I do now, I do for the survival of our civilization and those best suited to carry our legacy forward. The revolution is successful, but survival depends on drastic measures. Your continued existence represents a threat to the well-being of society. Your lives mean slow death to the more valued members of the colony. Therefore, I have no alternative but to sentence you to death. Your execution is so ordered. Signed, Kodos, Governor of Tarsis IV.
So unexpected were the words he heard that it took Lorca an extra moment to process their true meaning. He was not alone, as he exchanged shocked looks with his team, even as a renewed rumbling erupted from the amphitheater audience.
"Did he just—" said Bridges,
but the words died in her throat. Lorca heard but did not acknowledge her, transfixed by the screen as the unimaginable began. Howls of energy cascaded across the open-air venue, and Lorca immediately recognized the reports of large-scale energy weapons. Visible in the tunnel entrances on the amphitheater's upper levels were oversized phaser cannons, variations of which were employed throughout Starfleet and the Federation for ground-based defense, as well as more innocuous missions like drilling underground passages for mining efforts or tapping subterranean energy or water sources. Never in his life had Lorca seen them utilized in the manner he now beheld.
"Holy shit!"
It was all the reaction he could muster as the deadly beams swept across the field, slicing through the assembled colonists with vicious efficiency. Then it hit him.
"Belena! No!"
Cries of terror and anguish filled the air, punctuated by the shrill whine of the weapons playing over the crowd. Lorca realized with mounting horror that the shouts from the assembled colonists were decreasing in number and intensity with every passing second as bodies upon bodies disintegrated in the face of the onslaught. The weapons were set to maximum, both the larger cannons as well as the rifles wielded by dozens of security officers positioned in the stands high above the field. Their hellish attacks left nothing in their wake except the fading shrieks of men, women and children who had unwittingly marched to their own deaths. And somewhere in the midst of that slaughter was Belena.
"We have to do something," said Sultani,
but Lorca knew it was a reflexive response, a desperate bid to ward off the unspeakable massacre being carried out before their eyes.
He understood and sympathized as waves of similar helplessness and torment washed over him. As abruptly as it began, the execution was over.
Not simply execution, Lorca chastised himself. Murder. Mass murder.
Smoke hung in the air above the field, large portions of which were burned and pitted in the wake of the assault. A stifling silence descended over the scorched grass and dirt, upon which nothing moved, upon which nothing remained to move. Tearing his eyes from the grisly scene, Lorca saw that the podium was empty. Kodos was gone. He had to still be there, somewhere at the amphitheater, likely being moved to a secured location. Save for the Starfleet outpost, there were no transporters in use anywhere in the colony, so Kodos and his escorts would have to rely on conventional transportation. But where would they go? Lorca wanted him. He wanted the governor's throat in his hands. He wanted to feel the other man's pulse beneath his fingers, its rate increasing with each passing moment as he squeezed ever tighter, until the beats stopped, or the windpipe cracked, or he simply ripped that handful of tissue free as the light faded from Kodos's eyes.
Belena.
Commander. It was Bridges now standing so that she blocked Lorca's view of the screen.
Sir, are you—
Looking past her, he saw that the image of the amphitheater was gone, replaced by a man standing before what Lorca recognized as the backdrop for one of New Anchorage's prominent news stations. The man was saying something about the curfew being once more in full effect, and that violators would be arrested. Security forces were being deployed throughout the city, no doubt to contain what would be at least some demonstrations of resistance and violence once they finished absorbing the shock of the slayings they just witnessed. Warnings about confronting the colony's law enforcement officers also were issued, with severe penalties promised for any attacks or other acts of insurrection.
"It doesn't make any damn sense," he said after a moment, forcing words and thoughts to order themselves. Even with help weeks away, they could have survived. Ration the available food. Find some way to hang on long enough for help to get here.
Even with half the population, said Sultani, the colony would be stretching the small amounts of uncontaminated food to a startling degree. They could survive, but it would by no means be pleasant.
Bridges added, but to just decide that half the population needed to die? To save the other half? How does one make that kind of decision? Based on what criteria?
We have to take him into custody, said Sotani. Somehow. But it won't be easy. How large is the security contingent?
Lorca shook his head.
I don't know. A couple of hundred, maybe? The surviving colonists certainly outnumber them.
He realized the magnitude of what that meant. 4,000 people cut down within minutes, while he was forced to watch them die.
There's no way this Kodos decided to do this without a plan of some sort, said Sotani. He had to know that there would be people who lashed out in anger and grief.
The computer specialist gestured to the viewing screen.
If he was prepared to do that, then he's ready to kill anyone else who tries to move against him.
Bridges said,
but why? At first I thought he might simply be insane, but that doesn't explain the help he obviously had in order to pull this off.
I don't know, said Lorca, but I'm going to find out.
He pushed aside the image of Belena, which was at the forefront of his mind, forcing himself to concentrate on the matter at hand.
Before we can do that, we have to get a message to Starfleet. They have to know what happened here and what to expect when help arrives. For all we know, Kodos is planning something against whatever ship gets here first. We can't let anyone walk into this situation blind.
It's a safe bet Kodos will be looking for us, said Bridges. He has to know we can't let this go unanswered.
Sultani asked,
so, what do we do?
They'll be expecting us to run and hide somewhere, said Lorca. We've got one chance at surprising them before they're on to us, so we need to make it count.
He looked around the apartment, which was nothing more than a cruel reminder of what Kodos had taken from him.
This place is probably safe for tonight, but there's no way to know if they're aware of my relationship with Belena, so we'll have to figure out something else.
We can't go to anyone we know in the city.
He cast an involuntary glance to the viewing screen, assuming any of them survived. They could not return to the outpost. It was the first place security forces would look. Instead, they would need to hide, blend in, become invisible, and perhaps attempt to locate and detain Kodos, all while waiting for help to arrive. One way or another, the executioner had to answer for his crimes. Lorca would make that his mission. Belena and 4,000 other people deserved no less.
Six. Could I have been so completely wrong?
The roof of the apartment building afforded Kodos a view offered by very few structures in the area. From here, he had what should be a wondrous panorama of New Anchorage. At this hour, well after sundown, streets and walkways would be illuminated, and lights from countless windows would appear as small constellations begging for acceptance from the stars far above. Instead, as he leaned against the parapet encircling the building's roof and looked over the city, the vast majority of the windows he could see were dark, leaving only the street lamps and other external light sources to paint New Anchorage's nighttime portrait. The scene tonight was punctuated by scattered fires of varying size. Alarms from street level were carried on the breeze, and if he strained to listen, Kodos could hear shouts and other sounds associated with bands of protesters.
"Reports are coming in from across the city," said his assistant, Ian Galloway. "Security units are responding to dozens of calls. Most are gatherings of fewer than 10 people, but there's concern that small groups may band together the longer this continues."
There was a pause, and Kodos saw Galloway looking at something on the tablet he carried in his left hand. The younger man appeared tired. His clothing and his dark brown hair looked disheveled, as though he'd been awakened at a very early hour and working all through the day. To Kodos, Galloway also looked a little afraid. "The bulk of the population seems to be complying with the curfew and the other emergency rules we put in place, but some of the watch commanders are worried that won't last." The unrest was to be expected, Kodos knew, once the surviving population was able to process the shock of the sacrifice, as he had taken to calling the event at the amphitheater. There was the initial anticipated outcry, of course, but direct action in the first hours was muted, thanks to the efforts of security forces enforcing the curfew. Fewer than 36 citizens were arrested that first night, but that number was exceeded long before nightfall today. It would only get worse.
"Perhaps another speech is in order," said Galloway.
"A new message to the people, asking for calm and reassuring them that everything's going to be fine." Turning from the parapet, Kodos eyed his assistant with unabashed skepticism.
"What is there to say? How can I possibly make them understand that we were acting in what we believed was the best course for the colony's continued survival?"
In the beginning, simple math had been the biggest driver of his decision. More than 8,000 colonists, with enough food to sustain less than half that number until Starfleet aid was supposed to arrive. In the face of such cold, incontrovertible facts, what else could he do? Rationing would only prolong suffering rather than alleviate it, and to what end? The loss of perhaps the same number of people as those chosen for the sacrifice, and the continued suffering of those left behind? His solution, though harsh, at least possessed a virtue of mercy, and carried with it the possibility of protecting the community from dissolution. Would anyone believe as much decades from now, once the story of this tragedy was committed to the pages of history?
"Yes, there are those who supported us. But how many will step forward and proclaim that allegiance?"
Kodos shook his head.
"I suspect that number will be very low."
"You were acting in all our best interests, sir." Even as Galloway spoke the words, Kodos heard the faint hint of doubt in the other man's voice. That was understandable, he conceded. Upon witnessing the sacrifice while standing at his governor's side, Galloway's immediate reaction was, like so many others, shock and disbelief. But to Kodos's surprise, his assistant seemed to process everything unfolding before him with quick efficiency before turning to the governor and saying what Kodos himself believed to be true. The words, uttered with a touch of uncertainty, still rang in his mind.
It is unfortunate, sir, but necessary.
What we face are trying times, Ian, said Kodos, but I have to believe that those of us who survive this challenge will come away better for the experience. Our true mettle will have been tested, and we'll be able to apply the harsh lessons learned here toward improving the quality of life for future generations.
Others expressed similar sentiments, including the majority of men and women who accompanied him to Tarsus IV a decade earlier in search of a fresh start and new opportunities. While there were hints of concern regarding the ramifications of the sacrifice once Federation aid arrived, a number of people were beginning to express at least some degree of understanding for what he had ordered. Or was that merely his perception, viewed through a clouded filter of bias and desired validation? It was something he had pondered at length while finalizing his decisions as to who would be submitted to the sacrifice. The choices involved several factors, including each colonist's perceived value and potential future contributions to the community, not just in the short term, but for years and decades to come. How could such a determination be made, when the future was a vast unknown? Crafting his analysis was no easy task, and it could not be delegated to another party. Doing so meant inviting the possibility of emotion into the mix, rather than relying on objective facts and reasoned extrapolation and insight based on the available information. Kodos was certain only he could provide the proper dispassionate perspective necessary to make his final selections. Likewise, Kodos knew only he would receive the full brunt of historical examination, persecution, and ultimate judgment.
So be it.
You should say something, Governor, said Galloway. The situation in the streets is escalating, but it's not yet out of control. There's still time to make the populace see reason. Kodos blanched at the notion.
I fear that opportunity is lost. Now that people are learning help is on the way, the sacrifice will be seen as unnecessary.
Sadness welled up within him. Despite his efforts to assert control over resources, such as the colony's main communications center, Kodos and his followers were unable to keep one lone security officer from broadcasting to the city his receipt of a message from a Starfleet vessel that would be here within a day, if not sooner. How this was even possible, Kodos did not know, given the last report sent from Starbase 11 indicating help was several weeks away, if not longer. The circumstances behind that sudden change were unimportant, of course. All that mattered was the impact to the colony. Armed with this news, more and more citizens felt emboldened. They were seeking retaliation, either in response to lost loved ones or friends, or simply acting out against the sacrifice. Unable to take out their anger on Kodos, they were channeling their increasingly runaway emotions on his surrogates, the security forces. Still others were launching or joining protests of varying size and intensity, the most visible signs of which were the fires Kodos could see from here on the roof. On the street in front of this building, he saw a group of 7 people running down a sidewalk while being chased by security officers. Behind them was a ground vehicle consumed by flames.
"How many security officers do we have on hand?" he asked.
Galloway stepped forward until he stood just to Kodos's left. 374 remain on the active rolls. 22 resigned their positions, and 4 have been injured during altercations. He paused long enough for Kodos to cast a glance in his direction before adding, "There's no way to know how many more we may lose, sir." Nodding in understanding, Kodos said,
"That also is to be expected. The past days have tried our souls. It's reasonable that there will be those who cannot find the strength within themselves to continue."
Only a small, trusted number of the colony's security officers knew of the sacrifice before Kodos finalized his plans. Though he solicited advice from a cadre of trusted advisors, the ultimate decisions were his alone. He knew this would not matter once the Federation learned of what happened here,
but it was his hope to mitigate the scope of people caught up in the affair once the truth came to light. When he informed the men and women who would be tasked with carrying out the solution, many of them balked, but Kodos had chosen his people well. Despite their initial uneasiness, those loyal to him accepted the necessity of the actions. The remainder of the security details were caught up in the sacrifice's aftermath. Kodos harbored no doubts that they were torn between